Our shir this morning is kindly sponsored by Dr. Abe and Michelle Zerika on the occasion of Abe's the 20th yahrzeit of Abe's mother Zerika, which is this Thursday on the 8th of Tammuz. L'nishmas Golda Bas Israel Zelig v'Chana Perel Aleha Hashalom be'ezras Hashem, that the continued learning, the continued aliyah of the mishpacha as a whole should be continue to give her nachas for many years to come. Thank you for sponsoring. So we're gonna learn today. If you haven't had a chance to be the last year, that's fine. We're gonna focus on one idea today, and this idea is a profound one. It's a personal story, and I'd like to share that personal story with you as we learn together and as we grow together. And I just want to start off with the first statement, and that is the purpose and the goal of this is that we're all here. We're learning. We're trying to appreciate the Torah. We're trying to understand the Torah. We're trying to get closer to Hashem. And I think that should be the focus, the humble focus of any learning of Torah. And I said especially in this particular topic because that sometimes a lot of people start these discussions or these investigations with agendas, and they end up in the same spot that they started, just with a lot of proofs that they've rallied to their cause. And I think it's important to understand that this is a topic which requires a great amount of humility, a great amount of trying to find the right way, trying to find, in fact, what the right direction is. If it's all right, I just want to see over here. If somebody could just help me plug this in, then I think we won't lose the screen. Thank you so much, Adam. I apologize, Adam. Thank you so much. Just makes it a little easier there this way, not to lose it. So let's start at this, at the very beginning. We spent a little bit of time last time. We learned a little bit about the Radzina Tcheles, and just a little bit of background about the Radzina Tcheles. In the 1880s, thank you so much, Adam. In the 1880s, we know that the Radzina Rebbe, Rav Leina, set out on a massive investigation in which he first published three books. Sifune Temune Echol, which is his first book about the idea that you can, in fact, recover the Chilazon, the Tcheles. And then he wrote another book called the Psil Tcheles and the Eina Tcheles. The Psil Tcheles was identifying what he believed was the Tcheles. And the last book, Eina Tcheles, was his response to many of the Gedolim, the rabbinic leaders of his generation, that he spoke to trying to advance his cause. And the identity of the creature that he suggested was the common cuttlefish, which is the Sepia officinalis. And the reason why he chose that creature, there's many, many reasons. He wrote a whole sefer on it, so it's hard to trivialize that into one sentence. But suffice to say that the one of the usages of the sepia is ink. It produces a black, very dark blue black ink. And so he believed that here you have an ocean creature that met many of the ideas that were stipulated in the Gemara and the Rishonim, and he believed that this is what, if he could find a way to dye it into a garment in a way that it is non-soluble, that it can't be washed away by water, which is one of the problems. The sepia's liquid is soluble. So therefore, he believed it would be possible to perhaps regain the art of dyeing the tcheles. And he was attacked from three different angles, three very different ways of questioning it. One question was the question of identity. And ultimately, this question of identity was the one that won the day. And that is in terms of whether or not he was actually getting the right creature or not. Was he, in fact, producing a creature which was correct scientifically? Was this the right one which matched the signs of the Gemara? So later on, as we learned a little bit at the end of last week, 2 weeks ago, Rav Herzog, the second chief rabbi of Israel, in his doctoral thesis in London when he was doing his PhD, he did it on the subject of Tcheles. And he actually reached out to the Radzina Chassin, and by now, Rav Leina himself was no longer here, he was Niftar. So he reached out to his dynasty and said, can you tell me what the methodology is for the production of Tcheles? And they sent him to the chemist. And the chemist gave them the chemical formula that was necessary. And he re-performed the experiment himself in his own laboratory a number of times. And he found that the color which was creating the dye was in fact not the sepia itself, but the chemicals added in order to create the solubility. In other words, the chemist understood the goals and the needs of the Radzina Rebbe. And therefore, he added in enough material chemically to create the blue, which ultimately turns out to be chemically Prussian blue, which is a dark blue. If you've ever seen the Radzina Tcheles, it's still around today. It's a darker blue. And ultimately, you could use any other organic substance and mix it with what the ingredients that chemist was adding, and it also turned Prussian blue. In other words, it wasn't a function of the sepia. But unfortunately, the Radzina Rebbe was not aware of this, as Rav Herzog says this. Rather, Radzina Rebbe did an incredible amount of research, did an incredible amount of travel, did an incredible amount of chakira into this. And when he came around, he felt, Rav Herzog says explicitly in his thesis, he says he believes that the chemist took advantage of him. The chemist knew that he wanted the goal of an insoluble blue dye. And the chemist did what was necessary to give him the result. But ultimately, it wasn't a function of the material that he was using, unfortunately. There are still Hasidim today in Breslov Hasidim, and still the Radzina Hasidim who still wear the Radzina Tcheles. Unfortunately, for this and for a number of other reasons, this is not the only reason. Another reason is because the Gemara says that one of the Simonim Tcheles is that it's expensive. Why is it expensive? Because it's rare. This is called a common cuttlefish for a reason. It's a common cuttlefish. It's found everywhere. And it's used for ink. It was used for ink for many, many, many years, for many centuries. So this is not something which fits that criteria either as well. These are two of the main questions in terms of identity. But there are other questions, not in terms of identity. There's a question which is, we'll call it a far more reaching, a more global question. And that is as presented by Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, the Beis Halevi. The Beis Halevi was in correspondence with the Radzina Rebbe. And in his Akdama, he records the correspondence he has. And here is what the Beis Halevi says. The Beis Halevi's claim is like this. If it's true that you have discovered the Tcheles, right, suddenly in the 1880s, you have found out what the Tcheles is, and it happens to be this common cuttlefish which is around, by the fact that for the last, if let's say we put the time that it disappeared around the year 630 or so, right, when we were talking about this last time. So from the year 630 to the year 1880, right, so 1200 plus years, this was around, and nobody was taking advantage of it. No other Godol be Yisrael, no other rabbinic authority was using the sepia officinalis to create the Tcheles. It's almost as if, he says, there's a Mesorah against your usage of this creature because nobody else is doing it. Simple as that. No one else was using it. It's almost as if there's a Mesorah against what you're doing. To which the Radzina Rebbe records this in his Akdama. You can read it all here. I didn't actually put the text in for this because it's a little hard to read over here. I have it in my notes. And the answer he responds to the Beis Halevi is, it took a lot of work. It wasn't so simple. I needed to go here, I needed to go there, we needed to research the chemical formula, I required investing a lot of money, it was not so simple. So there's no negative Masara if it required an incredible amount of investigation. We should be aware that there's another version of the Beis Halevi's question. And that is actually recorded in the Soloveitchik family by Rav Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik. He records it in a different way, not as recorded by the Radzina Rebbe. And the question that he held on Tcheles was actually much more of a formidable question. And here's how he worded it. Not that there's a negative Mesorah against it because nobody used it, but in order to reestablish anything of this magnitude, you need to have a Mesorah. You can't simply look at the clues and say this all adds up to what looks like the correct answer. You need to have a tradition which tells us that what you're looking at is what it is. Without that failing that, there is no way we can reconnect it. But by the way, this question would, in a certain sense, stop the whole subject. The whole discussion should end at this point in time, if this is based on the Beis Halevi's question, on the wording of Rav Soloveitchik's way of dealing with this. One should be aware that Radzina Rebbe never received that question because he doesn't respond to it. Meaning this version of the Beis Halevi's question would never reach the Radzina Rebbe, or he would have recorded it in his Sefer when corresponding. He was very intellectually honest. He wrote all of the tshuvos against him in his Sefer, and he doesn't record this. So that's one should be aware of. This question never arrived at him. But this in general, Rav Shershel Schechter has an article in Be'ikvei Atzon, in his second book. And in the Sefer, he discusses many questions that one could all raise about this. Remember, Rav Yoshe Ber was Rav Herschel Schechter's Rebbe. One could ask many questions. There's times where, for instance, you know, anybody here eat turkey as an example? Right? So turkey is not talked about in the Torah. Simply isn't, right? America was not discovered at that point in time when the Torah was talking. So we don't have a specific story about this bird, but we know the rules. And we apply the rules, and we know that ultimately it applies. Okay, we know the rules and the system. We can work it out. There's other examples of Mesorah. So for instance, let's say there are people who don't eat it today. There are a very small group who don't. But I just want to point out that Roiv Ruboy Shel Klal Yisrael do. As another example, when it comes to Tefillin. Tefillin is an example where we have two, perhaps four Mesoros as an example. Right? Many Ashkenazim wear Tefillin Shel Bere Rashi. Tefillin Shel Bere Rashi, there's two separate Mesoros. Now, it's not the same over here. We don't have a Mesorah, right? But the point is, we have two Masoras over here, and some people say, well, we'll go with this Masora. Some people say, we'll do both Masoras. There's times where we don't have a single Masora when it comes to, let's say, birds. There's numerous times in the Gemara when we look at what the word Orez means. What does Orez mean when the Gemara Brachos talks about it? How do we arrive at what that is? What are the Chameshus Aminim in when it comes to Minei Dagon? Some of these are discussions in the Rishonim. The Rishonim say, all the evidence points towards a particular entity, and we're going to go with this. What about Kinoa, Kinoa? There's complicated questions that we have which are not talked about explicitly. And we have to use the tools we have to apply, even though we don't have a Masora. So yes, this is a very formidable question. And one has to be aware of this. This is a very serious question. And those who would follow the Beis Halevi would say that based on this version of the question, it's a very hard question to answer. And I want to put it out there. It's a very hard question to answer, this version of Beis Halevi. The version that the Radzina Rebbe received, he answered already himself. That's in terms of Masora. And there's a third question, a type of question, which was asked. And this was from Yeshua's Malko, Rav Yisrael, Yeshua Trunk, who asks, and it's interesting that the Radzina Rebbe, in his Ein HaTzcheles, records all the correspondence, the backwards and the forwards, of his correspondence with the Yeshua's Malko. And one of the questions that he raises, he quotes in Arizal, it's actually a Midrash, appears in the Sifrei and the Midrash Rabban by Midbar, which says that the Chilazon, that this entity, this whatever this sea creature is, was hidden, Nignaz, until the times of the Bias HaMashiach, which in a certain sense would therefore stop all search, meaning to say, why would you be looking for it, the Red Zina Rebbe? Why would you be searching for it if it's supposed to be Nignaz? It's going to be hidden for all future times until Mashiach comes. So it's a good question. It's a very vague word. The word nignaz is a very vague term. And we already saw that part of the problem with this question is to take that midrash literally, is that we know that the chilazon was extant to after the closing of the Gemara. We know that throughout the entire period of the Gemara, they had the chilazon. They had the tcheles. They were using it, even in Babylon. They were bringing it in from Israel. The Gemara never talks about it in nignaz. In fact, they talk about the production of it, even in the times of the late Amorim. So clearly, 6 centuries... after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, they still had the chilazon. It wasn't dependent on the Beis HaMikdash being there at all, clearly, historically speaking, at all. Similarly, there are other versions.
Is it possible that they have left over of the blue of the chilazon?
Do they have examples of that?
That it was left over. They didn't rediscover it. Or
you know, Shmuel, I want to get to it, but if it's all right, I have so much material. I want to go sequentially, and I want to go through it. There's going to be so much coming. We're just at the very, very tip of the iceberg over here. I will not get through all the material. I'm just telling you ahead of time. So in terms, this is a question. Also, the Sifrei, when you read the Sifrei and talks about it, Nignaz, it doesn't talk about the times of the Mashiach. It talks of the time that the Tzadikim, the Asid Lavoi, are going to find it. Who the Tzadikim, when is the Asid Lavoi? Very vague references. It's very hard to know when this is, and certainly considering the fact that it already was. In fact, the person in the Sifrei, who Rabbi Yose, who talks about it being Nignaz, lived at a time that it was still extant. So what does Rabbi Yose mean? So one of the Pirushim on the Tosefta says that what it really means is it says the type of chilazon that was used for the dye and for the Kohen Gadol, that was Nignaz. But the common chilazon that every single Jew, every single male had to put on their tzitzis, Rabbi Yossi lived at a time that it was existent. It cannot be taken at face value. These are the three general type of questions. A question of identity, a question of Masara, and a question of whether it's actually extant now or not. These three questions, of course, will be pushed further forward in history when it comes to the future discoveries and questions about the future, the chilazon in the 20th century. And these obviously will apply themselves in the same way. It should be worthwhile noting that the reason of the dismissal, the main reason for the dismissal of the Radzina Tcheles was the first one, a question of identity. It is clear that the sepia is not the Tcheles because it is not producing the dye which we see in the wool. It is the chemist. It's the chemist's extra added chemicals. Let's move a little further into history. Actually, we looked at that. Actually, I put it in a little closer to the text. We're not going to go through it right now for the sake of time. Let's move on to the next thing. We move on to Rav Herzog. Rav Herzog was a genius, and it just, you know, it pains me when I've heard other people giving shirim, and they quote the Rav Herzog, and they misquote him. You know, you really ought to, just if you want to learn about Rav Herzog, you have to print out his doctoral thesis of 300 pages. You really ought to read it. You really ought to read his handwriting. And if you want to, it's available online. You can get this. So I've heard people seriously butchering quoting and misquoting him. You've got to read it. You've got to have the basic respect to read Rav Herzog before quoting and misquoting him. And it is easily available in terms of his doctoral thesis. And he goes through this. And by the way, not only was he a master in Chazal, in Rishonim and Achronim, he was writing letters in French, in German. He was writing in Hebrew across the world to all the associations of science in the world to find the Tcheles. He left no stone unturned when it came to this. Well, in certain areas, he will say, and this is my correspondence with Dr. So-and-so, who is the head of the Museum of Natural History in Paris. And here's what he says about this. And then let me come back to the Gemara. Does this really fit what we have to have a little bit of appreciation of what Rav Herzog was doing. So here we go. This is Rav Herzog actually in his doctoral thesis in the 19 when he was a younger man. This is the front page is semantic porphyrology, which is actually the study of porphyra. Porphyra is referring to a particular snail, and that's the purple snail. We'll get to it in a second as to why what it is. And this is actually his own handwriting. This is the typewritten notes over here. And he says the following. Let's see if we can get in. There we go. Okay, good. So he quotes the Gemara. The Gemara, this is his own writing. Remember that when everything's being typed over here, at this point in time, he had to write everything in Hebrew. So we get to see his own handwriting as he filled in all the gaps. And he quotes the famous Gemara, and he says the following. The Gemara says that there's three simonim, or there's more. But there's three simonim for the Tcheles. It says, the Chilazon is Gufoi Dome Leyam. Its body is similar to the sea. Briyasai, it's hard to see over here. Dome Ladag, its creation is similar to a fish. And it comes up once every 70 years. And with its blood or excretion, and we use it to dye tcheles. And therefore its value is expensive. That's what the Gemara says. It's the Gemara over here. Menachos, daf, mem, dalet, amud, aleph, and he puts it over there. So what he does is he says the following. He says, let's set out the criteria, right? So its body is the color, its body or its shell is like the sea. B, its shape or form is like a fish. And C, it comes up once in 70 years. So he puts down those, and then he goes through all of the suggestions. It wasn't just Rabbonim who were searching for Tcheles at this point in time. In the 1800s, there were many academics. So he goes through all the academics beforehand who gave suggestions as to what he says, how many criteria does it match? Then he goes through the Radzina. The Radzina's suggestion, the Radzina Rebbe's suggestion. He goes and he matches them all up, and he questions every single one of them based on these three criteria. He goes further, and ultimately, he rejects, as we talked about, he rejects the Radzina Tcheles. But he has his own suggestion. And his own suggestion is a type of snail called the Janthina. Janthina is a type of small snail, as you can see over here. It's a violet snail, which actually floats on the top of the water. It's very fascinating. If you take a look at the picture over here, it floats on the top of the water. It almost looks like a jellyfish, so to speak. When it comes out of its shell, it floats on the top of the water. They cluster together, and it gives out a violet-blue ink or color. And he believed that ultimately it fitted all of the three major criteria, and he spent a lot of his time researching and trying to find out how to create a dye from this particular snail, which he suggested and was perhaps it. Let's see if we can get in over here. If the present of all hope be about, if for the present, and by the way, this is on page 140, so it's not like as I'm just restarting at the beginning here. Okay, I'm just saying we have to appreciate it. It's like, you know, you can't quote one sentence of Rav Herzog and then assume that you understood Rav Herzog. So he says, if for the present all hope is to be abandoned of rediscovering the Chilazon Shel Tcheles, in some species of the genera Murex and Purpura, because he's just rejected them, we could do worse than suggest Janthina as not an improbable identification. By the way, do you notice the humility? Not an improbable suggestion, right? He's not saying, I know this 100%. He's saying, this is potentially a suggestion. The identification readily occurred to me at the beginning of the study on the subject. I was glad to find afterwards that I had been anticipated by a particular academic, and he actually has not yet put in the reference. That's interesting because this was an earlier version of his notes. On further investigation, I came across certain objections against identification with the Helix Janthina in particular. And he goes on to this, and he goes on and he shows how it relates to each of these particular signs. It stands with a letter in French in between from the head of the Museum of Natural History in Paris as it relates to the production necessary for this. What's fascinating is that ultimately the Janthina was not accepted. The reason, one of the reasons why he fought so hard for this particular shell or this particular snail was because they cluster together, they float on top of the water, and there are times when they will be swept up on the shore in huge storms, very infrequently, which matches what was the Gemara saying, As Oile Achas L'Shivim Shana. So he says that there's a cluster of appearances, and that was one of the things. And there's also Dom El Yam, it's Gufo Dom El Yam. Its blue violet shade is very much camouflaged with the scene. He felt that this was ultimately related to it. Ultimately, in history, it's been very hard to prove that this could be used as a dye. It's been very hard to prove that it can actually ever be used as a dye. Certainly, we have no historical documentation that it ever was used as a dye. But be it as it may, this was the suggestion Rav Herzog ended with tentatively on. We'd like to go backwards to one suggestion which he rejected. Let's see, did I get there over here? Oh, one second. Where did it go over here? Oh, yes. He rejected a particular suggestion. And this suggestion, I think, to us is a very credible, important part to start. And that is the suggestion which Rav Herzog was readily aware of, and that was called the Murex trunculus. Murex trunculus is a type of snail which inhabits certain Mediterranean coasts, not all the Mediterranean coasts, the northern coast of Israel, Spain, it's in Croatia as well. There's a number of places that it appears. The Murex is not the only snail. It's got a few sister species. There's the Murex banderas. There's another more purple version of it which don't appear in the Mediterranean. And I'd like to just discuss this particular suggestion which Rav Herzog ultimately rejects, why he rejects it, and perhaps why it is an important candidate to think about today. But the story for me starts a little earlier. It starts a number of years ago. When I was learning in Kollel in Chicago, I was in the YU Kollel at the time. And the YU Kollel, the way it was structured is that morning Seder, we had our morning Seder and Shir, every morning was Iyun, so we'd learn Gemara in depth. Afternoon Seder was Halacha. And evening was learning in the community Kollel. We'd learn with people from across the community over 90 chevros. This is a week. It was a beautiful thing. So the second year I was there, we were learning Menachos. Menachos is, in the morning, we were learning real Kodshim in Iyun, real sugyas in Kodshim. In the afternoon, the halacha that we learned in Menachos was in the Lamids, which is what's called Hilchos Stam. The halachas of Sefer Torah, Mezuzos, Tefillin, and Tzitzis. Right? So this was the halacha. And towards the end of the year, we got to the halachas of Tzitzis. As we were in our Seder, we went through Hilchos Sefer Torah, we went through Hilchos Mezuzah. We published a Kuntros action, and it was a very beautiful opportunity. At the end of the year, we were in the base Medrash. The YU Kollel learned in the same base Medrash as HTC. HTC is the Skokie Yeshiva. Skokie Yeshiva. So our two Kollelim would learn together. It was a beautiful thing. Fastman Yeshiva High School, right? The Skokie Yeshiva. It was a beautiful opportunity. And the Rosh Kollel is a person by the name of Rav Chaim Twersky. Rav Chaim Twersky is a person you probably have not heard of so much, and that's because he's an extremely humble individual. He doesn't put his name out there. He's not there to seek accolades and renown. And he's a genius. Brilliant, brilliant individual. And I would sit the bench ahead of him learning when he was behind me. You could ask him anything about anything. And it turns out we got to Simon Yud Aleph. We were talking, learning Hilchos Tzitzis in Rosh Chaim. And the suggestion came up, why don't we do a sugya on, let's do the Chabura, go through a sugya on Tchelet. So we started learning on it. Turns out that Rosh Chaim Twersky was one of the original Ba'alei Hadavar long before it all became popular. So he said, do you mind if I sit in on your Chabura? So the Rosh Kollel, of course, you can sit in on our Chabura. So one of the Chabura Kollel was given the Chabura. And he listened to this. At the end, he added all his details. And what's fascinating is he was the one who published the first RJJD article on this. When he was in Kollel learning about this, he was also learning Hilchos Tzitzis. And what he did was he sent a letter to Scientific American and Nature, the magazines, and he said, here is what I'm looking for. Here are the criteria it needs to match. What creature could this be? And they sent him back the response saying, the creature you're looking for is the Murex trunculus. There's one problem. Its color is purple. And that's when he stopped his research, until the 1980s. We'll see why in just a second. Something happened. But he wrote an RJJ article, which he's updated since, and I think it's really worthwhile just appreciating the perspective that he has before entering this. And just these are his words and in discussing this. Here's what he says. In recent years, a group of religious scientists who have formed an association called Amutat Ptil Tchelet look up the task of finding the elusive chilazon. They claim that this time their efforts have been met with success. At the outset, any such claim should be greeted with a healthy dose of skepticism, since even the esteemed Rav Liner was in error in this very matter, and the skepticism that greeted his claim was proven to be quite justified. If so, we must suspect that lesser qualified persons would be at least as likely to come to an erroneous conclusions. That's a very important point. Let's greet this with temerity. Let's greet this with care. However, and this is an important part, this paragraph, I believe, is something which most people skip over in the angry and vociferous debate. However, this should not mean that the claim of the modern discovery should be ignored. Rather, it needs to be examined carefully And if, after carefully weighing the evidence, it turns out that the claim lacks foundation, it should be rejected. On the other hand, if the evidence in favor of positive identification is overwhelming, then the return of Tchelet should be accepted by the majority of Shomrei Mitzvos, for this will afford Chovevei Mitzvos an opportunity that has not been available for nearly 1,400 years. It should thus be regarded with great excitement and enthusiasm as a precious and dear element of the mitzvah of tzitzis may well have been retrieved. That perspective is the starting point. Whatever we end up getting to, let's start with the opportunity of fulfilling a mitzvah which we haven't had. That's remarkable. Let's start there. Now we can have the discussion. Now with humility of saying, we're not going to wholeheartedly accept it, but at the same time, we're going to be very careful, and there's a great deal of excitement if this works out. That's the way to start this discussion. I've seen lots of demagoguery in this business, people mocking other people. Let's start off with the perspective that's correct. This is Rav Tversky's humility over here. What was fascinating is that after the Chabura finished, I was standing in the room and I was asking Rav Tversky a number of questions myself. And in walked Rav Yonah Reis. Rav Yonah Reis at this time was becoming the Av Beis Din of the CRC in Chicago, one of the most outstanding Talmidei Chachamim of our generation. If anybody ever has the opportunity of listening to him, to hearing him, a Dayan Mumche, person who's Baki in the Dalet Chilke Shulchan Aruch, he comes into the room and he was at this point in time visiting Chicago. And so I was speaking to Rav Tversky, and he says, so what have you been learning? So Rav Tversky says, we're learning the Sefer Tcheles. So without skipping a beat, Rav Reis launches into all the questions on the recent discovery. Question after question after question after question, because even though Rav Reis was not in the sugya, he knows all the questions. And very quietly and very silently, Rav Tversky stood there and answered them, one by one by one by one, every single one of them. And I was the only other person in this room just listening to this interface between Dayan Reis and Rav Tversky. It was such an illuminating moment. I think for me that was a very important moment, just to appreciate the dialogue of Torah, what a dialogue of Torah should look like. And I'd like to just recount some of those perspectives. And this is, I'm not going to, it's my journey was not through Dr. Sturman and all the other, this was my personal journey, so I'd like to share. So Rav Herzog rejected the Murex. He knew about the Murex. Everybody knew about the Murex. The Murex was one of the most popular and sought after dyes in the times of antiquity. This is not a secret. There are dyeing houses and there are broken shells of the Murex in the way that it was used by the gland that was removed in order to get the dye on the Phoenician coast from North Israel all the way to Tyre. This is all evidenced. Clearly, the question which exists is, there's four questions which Rav Herzog left, and these are the questions that he has. Number one is that the primary dye of the Murex trunculus is purple, what we call in Hebrew, argamon. It was used for argamon. There's no question in the world that it produces purple. The dye is a purple dye. No question. So that should really end the entire discussion. And that's why he said one of the reasons is it cannot be that this is the trellis, because we know that the trellis is doimer liam, which is doimer lirukia, which is doimer to the sapphire of the kisar kovod, which is the color blue. So it cannot be. And yes, some people try to stretch and maybe purple's included. It's not purple. It's blue. So it cannot be that. Number one. That's number one. Now, in terms of his other question was, it wasn't permanent. It was not a permanent dye. Right? So I mean to say that based on the chemistry at the time, the one of the simonim of the Gemara is that it needs to be insoluble to a degree that it cannot leave the garment. Right? It doesn't dissolve. And he felt we'll get there in a second, why the chemistry works. He said, without chemistry, it needs to be insoluble, needs to be a dye which does not leave the garment. That was his second question. His third question was that the dye needs to be like the body needs to be doimer liyam, right? So what color is the murex shawl? Actually, just worthwhile looking at it. Where did I put mine? I just had it a second ago. Here we are. So here this is actually the murex shell. Just as worthwhile, actually, you know, before talking about things, you should really learn about them. So here, this is the murex shell. This is what the murex trunculus looks like. A murex trunculus, as you can see, it's a white or tan shell. They're different kinds. So some of them have bands of red, some and brown and black. But it's essentially a shell. Now, what Rav Herzog says is this is not doimer liyam. This doesn't look like the sea. That's a very valid claim, right? The murex does not look like the sea. And number four is his Gemara that he quoted in Menachos, Daf Mem Dalet Amud Aleph, which says it's oile echad l'shivim shana, that it arrives every 70 years. We don't see that. The murex is in the rock pools and is in the deeper seas of the Mediterranean. It does not arrive suddenly once every 70 years, so therefore we rejected it. So just to come back to some of the questions, to respond to some of the questions, Rav Tversky responds to them, many other people respond as well. But I'd just like to respond to them one by one. Number one, in terms of the dye not being blue, this is the most remarkable discovery. In 1983, After Otwersky had already sent his letters and his exchanges with the Scientific American and Nature and his whole discovery, and he came to a dead end because the Murex, which is the right creature which matches everything else, is giving us purple, a discovery was made. A very basic discovery, and that is that if during the dyeing process, how does dyeing process work? Just to come back to this for a second. For any dye to work, a dye needs to be non-soluble. That means to say it cannot be washed away by water. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a very good dye. The first time you take a swim, that's it, right? First time it rains, you're done. It doesn't work like that. It needs to be unsoluble. But the problem is how do you take a non-soluble solution and make it inextricably connected to how do you dye it into a garment? So what do? You reduce it. You add a chemical agent. In those days, they used to use urine, just out of interest, right? It was so as one of the reducing agents. They would break up the chemical properties of it, mix it into the cloth, and then take the cloth out. As the cloth is exposed to air, to oxygen, it now returns to its original chemical structure. And where is it? It's in the garment. Now it's unsoluble. It can't be taken out. That's how it works. So the chemicals are not changing it. The chemicals are simply allowing it to be reduced to get into the garment. If during the process of reduction, the Murex trunculus, it's not the whole Murex trunculus, it's at the very top over here. Underneath here is a gland that if you break the shell at this point at the very, very top, there's a little gland which extracts a very little amount of yellowish liquid. You take that yellowish liquid out. That is what ultimately is used for the dye. If you take the dried liquid and you put it in, you reduce it and you add it, and that process is done in sunlight, it no longer produces purple. It produces blue. The same thing. Nothing was added. By the way, just we did this personally ourselves when we were in Eretz Yisrael. This is just wool. We actually did the process ourselves. Just worthwhile doing this and seeing it. We were there together. We did this all together. And you can actually see we did it a little imperfectly. We were doing this as amateurs, so you can already see that when you look at the wool over here, you can see although much of it is blue, there's strands of purple. Right? Can you see the purple in it? The reason why the purple's there is because we didn't do it perfectly. We're not experts, so we were mixing it together. We did it in the sunlight, but not all of it got exposed or long enough to the sunlight, so some of the purple came through. If it's done in shade, it is purple. If it's done in sunlight, it is blue. But it's not just that. So that's number one in terms of that realization. Number two, I'm going to get back to that and come back to this point in a moment. The dye is not especially permanent. Unfortunately, at this point in time, Rav Herzog was not well informed chemically about the production of dyeing of the Murex. And in fact, Rav Twersky, and this is one of the godless of Rav Twersky, is one now that we understand the dyeing process of how to really do this with the Murex, which has now been perfected over the last number of decades, he took a Murex trunculus dyed blue and he put it into bleach. Bleach was such a high concentration that were it to be a higher concentration, the wool would dissolve. And he left it there for 3 days and remained unaltered. This is one of the tests the Gemara talks about. The Gemara talks about a test of whether it loses its color. When it's dyed correctly, it does not lose its color. Not even in bleach after 3 days. Just to appreciate this. Now, its gufo needs to be dame liyam. Its body needs to be similar to the sea. This is not what the Murex looks like in the sea. For anybody who's been to the rock pools out there, up there by Zichron Yaakov, and I've been there in the sea, and you go there and you want to look in the rock pools and see what it looks like, the ocean fouling agents cover this completely in a brown way. It's completely covered. It's covered with all kinds of things. It's very hard to see. It looks just like the rocks that it sits on. It looks just like the rock pools and everything else that it is. The shell that Rav Herzog was presented was the clean shell, and he's correct. It doesn't look like the sea, but that was not how it exists in its natural habitat. And finally, it does not appear once in every 70 years. Very hard to understand that. It is impossible for any dyeing agency, and certainly something which every male in the nation of Israel should be wearing on a daily basis, to be wearing tcheles, it's very hard to imagine that any dyeing industry would work if its product only came once every 70 years. It is clear that the Gemara cannot be talking literally. Maybe it refers to breeding patterns. Maybe it refers to, we'll call it weather patterns of how often more would be swept up. Maybe it refers to the fact that it's not so common. It isn't so common. It's only on certain parts of the Mediterranean coast, unlike the sepia, as an example. Maybe it refers to some of that. But the point is clearly over here, it's very hard to understand what that means, what the Gemara says when it's Oyle Acha L'Shivim Shara. But it cannot mean literally, because there's no way any dyeing industry would exist if it only had its product bought in once every 70 years. It must refer to some other rareness, which Rav Twersky suggests. That's in terms of addressing it. Here's the two different colors. Here's the blue and here's the purple, based on the same Murex trunculus. Let's go a little further over here. We're going to come back to this now. Some aspects. And this is important. I've heard so many shirim where they start off all these questions. Before we start off the questions, let's appreciate the proofs. Let's just start off at the very beginning. Let's start off at the beginning. What does tcheles look like? What does it look like? The answer is we know exactly what tcheles looks like. Why? Because first of all, the Midrash tells us that it's domele yam, domele rakia, domele kisei akavod. We know that it's blue. But even that, there's a debate. Some of the Rishonim say it's dark blue, like the evening sky. Okay. Well, there's a reason why one can know exactly what it looks like, because the Gemara Menachah, the Gemara in Bava Metzia, talks about why it is that at the end of the paragraph of talking about tzitzis, which we read this morning, talks about Ani Hashem Elokeichem. Why does it say Hashem needs to say I'm Hashem your God? So the Rava tells us the Gemara in this is the Gemara actually in Shabbos Samech Aleph on the base. It's important to quote sources because some people claim this is the rabbis versus the scientists. Let's start off with the rabbis. Let's appreciate that this is the Gemara talking, not the scientists talking. The Gemara itself starts off and says that very clearly, that the reason why it says Ani Hashem Elokeichem is because Hashem says, I'm the one who's going to notice the difference between people who play around and play games with me. What's a person who play games with me, says the Gemara? The Gemara says the person who knows the difference between Shetoyle Kala Ilon Bebidoi Vo'emer Tcheresu, a person who uses Kala Ilon, a certain other type of dye, puts it on their garments and says it's Tcheles. In other words, there is an imposter. There's something which looks just like the Tcheles. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who knows, who's able to be Mavchin between it and the real Tcheles, which is why Hashem says, Aniel Hashem Elokeichem. Fascinating. What is Kala Ilon exactly? We can know. There's a dictionary. The Aruch on the Gemara explains what the things are in the Gemara. He explains exactly what it is. And we use the Aruch for everything else. And Rashi quotes the Aruch, so we should use them here as well. What does Aruch say? Aruch is plant indigo. It's a plant dye. What is indigo? Indigo is a type of blue. It's fascinating. It's based on two different plants. And we use it as a basic dye. What is the chemical structure of indigo? We know what the chemical structure of indigo is. Plant-based indigo is over here. And it's actually just, I couldn't copy it in just because of the notes. But ultimately it is, okay, I actually deleted it. 12 carbons, 2 nitrogens, 2 hydrogens. It goes through the whole process. This is the chemical property of indigo. Do you know that the dye, which is used by the Murex Tranquillus, is called dibromine indigo? Which means to say that it is identical. That's the right next to it, Murex indigo, pre-sunlight. Has 2 bromine molecules attached to it, but it is identical to an indigo. And in fact, during the sunlight process, what happens to the bromine? The ultraviolet separates the bromine, yielding, when you look at this, this is the identical chemical structure to indigo. In other words, what the Gemara says, that it requires HaKadosh Baruch Hu to say, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, to notice the difference between indigo, plant indigo, the false, the imposter, and the real Tcheles. It is chemically identical to the Murex Tranquillus when used for blue, just to appreciate this. So do we know what the Tcheles looks like? Yes, we do, because we know what its imposter looks like. And we have a suggestion which is chemically identical to it. That this requires an Yashon HaKeichem. Let's just appreciate this. Let's go one step further. This is the Gemara in Shabbos. Let's go one step further. Where does it live? So we're told by the Bracha of Zvulun in Parashas Zos HaBracha, Amim ha-yurikro sham yizbuchu zivchei tzedek ki shefa yamim yinaku usufune temune chol. One of the brachas of Zvulun is that he has the Sifuna Timonechol, the riches hidden in the hordes of sand. What's that referring to? We all know this. We've all learned this. The Gemara, as is quoted by many of the Froshim, say, Zvulun felt that he was gypped. He didn't have enough of a territory. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, don't worry. You get something special. What do you get? You get a sea trade. And what's the sea trade? You get the Chilazon. You get the Chilazon. Now, just to appreciate this, first of all, that obviously means that it's expensive, which it is. It's obviously in the northern territory of Israel, which it is. But it was something also worthwhile noticing. Let's just translate those words again. Temune chol. What does the word chol mean? Sand. Do fish swim in the sand? No, it's something which is on the sand. It's something which stays in the rock pools. It's something which is clearly attached to the sand. Where does the Murex live? It lives on the sand. It lives on the rocks as you come to the beaches in the Mediterranean. Some people say it's a fish. We'll get to the fish in a second when it comes to objections. But just appreciate, the Torah, the way the Torah talks about it is something which lives in the sand. Let's go a little further. Does it have a shell? So people say, it's a fish. Why should it, how could it be this mollusk? How could it be a snail? You know, we always imagine that it, now what we imagined is really not relevant because we've not seen it for 1400 years, so our imagination is really null. Let's go back to Chazal to talk about it. Psikta de Rav Kahana. Psikta de Rav Kahana says over here, It's talking about actually the discussion of the Midbar experience where Bnei Yisrael were living through the desert and their clothes grew with them. And their clothes didn't require laundering. And the Gemara gives an example of why, of how that works. So the Psikta says. So this is in Psikta, Yud Aleph, Ois Chof Aleph, Rebbe Lezer Bar Shmaya, Shoal Es, Rebbe Shmaya Bar Rebbe Yossi, Bar Lukunya, Chamoya Omar Lei, Mahu Dein Dechsev. What is it that said in the Torah? Sim Losa Cholo Bolso Me'alecha. Shema Kli Kuryos Hayomah Mahalchin. I am Yisrael Bamidbar. Okay, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu wrapped them in the clouds, and that's what allowed their clothes to succeed. V'lo yu balim. Amalei, sinosachol abos amalecha, v'lo yu gudelim. Amalei, chilozon azeh, komashu gadil, nartikoi gadil imoy. Just like the chilozon. Why? The nartik, what does a nartik mean? The kava, let's be careful. The kava of the chilozon grows with it. Now, if I were to say to you, you know, look at this human being, remarkable human being, his kava grows with him. Because his skin and his bones, that's how it works, right? I don't say a fish. Look, its cover grows with it. Its skin grows with it. Yes, that's a regular phenomenon. If it's all about a nartik, we're talking about something which covers it. It sounds like there's a shell. In fact, there's another Gemara which is usually quoted as a proof against. The Gemara in Shabbos talks about this. It says, Hatzad Tzvi, it's all about hunting on Shabbos. The Gemara in Shabbos, Ayin Ham says, Ton Rabbanan, Hatzad Chilozon Vapoitzoi Enochai Velo Achas. The Gemara says, you hunt the Chilozon, and your poitzoi. Translate the word poitzoi for a second. What does the poitzoi mean? Break open. I don't know about you, but when I cut fish and I prepare it for Shabbos, when I go to the store and I ask them to prepare it, they're not breaking the fish with a mallet. Right? What are they doing? They're cutting it open. They're taking out the innards. They're taking out the bones. It is an inappropriate word to use the word poitzoi if we're referring to a fish. Clearly, when the Gemara talks about the chilazon, it refers to breaking open something. What's that breaking open? Lichor, it's a shell, but it gets more than that. It's even more than that in terms of this discussion. In terms of its expensiveness, the Gemara Menachos tells us, as we saw beforehand, lefichach dom of yukorin. Do you know how many shells, murex shells, it takes to dye four tzitzios? 25 murex it takes for one tzitzis, for one set of tzitzis. That's why it's expensive. It's really expensive. It was in those days, and it is today. The reason why nobility wore it in those days, one of the reasons why it was stopped being used, was because the nobility disallowed it being used for commoners. Or every commoner in Israel used to wear it, is because it's very rare. It costs a lot of money. It matches perfectly. It is not like the sepia, which is common. It is not something which is easily found and easily used. It requires a lot of effort and a lot of production to be able to do that. More than that, this is remarkable. You know, we know what tcheles, because the Torah talks about tcheles. Where does the word chilazon come from? The Gemara talks about it everywhere. The Gemara says talks about the word chilazon. Where does the word chilazon come from exactly? Where in Tanakh do you find the word chilazon? Here's a little experiment. This is an experiment myself. Anyone in the room Persian? Nobody know Persians in the room? Okay. If you have any Persian friends, I have Persian friends, ask them what the word for snail is in Persian. In fact, if you have friends who speak Arabic, ask them the same question. In fact, you can actually go online now and type in the following. After the shiur, you can go in and you can say, translate snail into Farsi. Google does it, and you'll get this word over here. Ask Google now to pronounce this word. You know what the word is? Halazun. That's the name for snail in Persian. It's the name for snail in Arabic. It's the name for snail in Assyrian. When the Gemara talks about the chilazon, the Gemara doesn't need to explain what it is if everybody knows that the chilazon is the snail it's referring to. It doesn't mean specifically the murex, it means snail in general. When the Gemara talks about that, is what the word chilazon means. Just to appreciate this, the Gemara was not taking this from the Torah. When you look at the Aramaic translations of chilazon, it's referring to what everybody understood was the Semitic language being discussed at the time. Appreciate this more. In fact, by the way, just coming back to this, so you're going to say, oh, this is scientific research. Do we take scientific research? Well, I mean, the Gemara is talking about it. But more than that, in the later, just to appreciate this, the later halachic decisors, as an example, the Ravya, he has another name for it. He calls it the Porpiro. He says the tcheles, the chilazon, is the porpiro. What is the porpiro? Greek word for? Murex trunculus. The ravya, shilti giboirim. Rashi's translation of the word for chilazon is the French word he uses in the same context to describe snail. We should really just be aware of these ideas, that this was not something which was suddenly lost and reinvented. Where is it hunted? The Gemara tells us where it was hunted. The Gemara tells us, it refers to a person as a yoygev, who collects the souls. It was from the promontory of Tyre and Haifa. Folks, that's exactly where the Murex trunculus resides. Not in South Israel, in North Israel. If you want to go to Murex Haya hunting, you go up north. Actually, it's interesting. In Israel, it's actually protected. You cannot use harvest the Murex in Israel. The murex, which is being produced and used for dye today, is taken off the coast of Spain and Croatia because they don't have as strict laws as Israel does in terms of harvesting murex. In fact, if you go into the waters there, you have to put them back. You cannot take them out in Israel. Just out of interest, it's a protected area, but it's all in northern Israel. Zichron Yaakov upwards, all that area upwards, northwards, which is exactly where the Gemara says it. And in fact, we have all these dye houses. We have the pools where they were used, which have been discovered archaeologically, with thousands of shells of the murex, which are broken in the specific area, not used for eating, but the top of the shell broken, which is where the gland was, taken out for the dyeing. This is where the dyeing houses were. This is important. I've heard certain people say, the dyeing houses is no proof, right? Because after all it was used was for argamon, for purple. And therefore, you have no proof whatsoever that this refers to Cheles. That's true. That's absolutely correct. It happens to be that the Gemara does say that the dyeing was done in this area. The Yogvim was done in the area, right? So we have no other dyeing industry which we found archaeologically. We do have this, which produces both argamon and Cheles. I think it's not a scientific proof. It's a scientific proof which is reflecting the Gemara's discussion about where you hunted. Let's be fair and let's be honest about this when it comes to it. Let's take it one step further. In terms of when it must be used, the Gemara Shabbos says that it's better to use it while it's still alive. It's better to extract the juice, to extract the enzyme, the liquid, while it's still alive, scientifically. If it's dead, it deteriorates so fast that it cannot be used. In fact, this is important. Unlike the sepia as a point, in the dyeing process of the murex, it is cut off. They break the shell. Mollusks don't have as many rights activists at this point in time. But they break the shell while it's still alive. They extract it. And they use the dye within hours. They dry it now to make it longer lasting. But when we didn't have those opportunities, it's something which requires almost immediate use. Let's go a little step further. Oh, the mysterious imposter. This to me. Rotursky says this, and he's actually quoting Rav Herzog. And this to me is just a remarkable question. One of the questions Rav Reis asked, this is a question that many people ask, is wait a second. How can you be so sure? You found it. Maybe really there is another aquatic creature in the Mediterranean, which is the real thing. And this one, yes, looks like it's good, but maybe you're missing it. Maybe there's another creature which exists, which is the real deal, Tcheles. So here's the funny thing. The Gemara talks about this notion of what's called Kala Ilon. Kala Ilon is indigo, plant-based indigo. And the Gemara says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows the difference between those people who use plant-based indigo and those people who use the real Tcheles. And therefore, there's a curse on such people, the Gemara says. Fascinating. But wait a second. And the Gemara didn't know that at the same time, there was this murex trunculus floating around, which has almost all the same properties as the Tcheles. And the Gemara never mentions this other imposter. It only mentions indigo. They are not discovering new ocean life in the Mediterranean shallow coast. They're discovering bacteria at this point. That's the size of the new discoveries being made in the shallow waters of the Mediterranean. We know the basic plant life and animal life in the shallow waters, which is where it was hunted. Now, let's think about this for a second. So why would the Gemara not talk about this terrible murex, which looks exactly like the... And in chemical structure, when exposed to sunlight, is identical to plant indigo. It only mentions indigo. That there can only be one explanation. The Gemara is not mentioning it. Clearly, the Gemara, this must be it. Or otherwise, it should have included it with Kala Ilan. Very basic proof. Another point, I was discussing with my brother-in-law a week ago, and he said it's a very interesting point. This is not like, we're not talking about like the Tzitzah Zohar that the Kohen Gadol wore, when the big day of the Shemona Begadim, that one person in Israel wore. We're talking about that every single male in a Jew has to wear on their tzitzis. This cannot be something which is fantastically arrived at once in a century, once in 70 years. And suddenly, we magically are able to make it that everybody wears it. This is something that every single Jew must wear. It has to be accessible. It has to be something which doesn't require a crazy amount of intrigue and complexity to arrive at the answer. That's a very important point. HaKadosh Baruch Hu lo bobe trunya in briyosov. It has to be something which is accessible. It has to be something which people know about. It has to be something which is obvious. This is, by the way, how many dyes, natural dyes, were there in antiquity? How many natural dyes were there before synthetic dyes in the 1800s? How many? Answer is 12. There were only 12 natural dyes. There is only one documented aquatic-based dye, and that's the murex trunculus. Let's put things in perspective. This magical creature that we're searching for, where did it come from? There's no documentation on any other creature. This is that in terms of just understanding where the things come from. Now, there are many questions. Many questions. I'm going to raise a number of them. And, of course, we're running out of time, and I do want to address a few of them. One question is Rabbeinu Bechaye. The Rabbeinu Bechaye says that it has to be a kosher species. Rabbeinu Bechaye says the chilazon needs to be a kosher species. So he's referring to the Mishkan, actually. He's one of the tcheles in the Mishkan. So here's the interesting thing about that, is that Rashi, as with many other people, disagree. Rashi says it's, in one way he describes it as a worm, right, a slug type of creature. which obviously matches the snail. In other places, the French word he uses for it is the snail itself. So clearly, Rashi does not think it's a kosher creature. Right? So just to appreciate this, there is no way to resolve the Rabbeinu Bachaye and Rashi. They cannot coexist whatsoever. There's no way for the two to be in common. In fact, Rabbeinu Bachaye is a das yachid when it comes to this. Because when you go through the Rabboseinu HaRishonim, and they talk about it, and they give the description which makes it clear that it refers to a snail, certainly the Radak, Rashi, the Ravyor, when you go through the Rishonim, and you talk about the Shilti Giboirim, the Chavos Yair later on, and they talk about it as a snail, it's clearly a non-kosher species. So it's very hard to be able to answer all the Rishonim as being on the same page. The Rambam is quoted. In fact, it's interesting. The Radzina the Rebbe based a lot of his research on this Rambam, on the Rambam in Hilchos Tzitzis Perek Beis Halacha Beis. The Rambam says a number of things which don't seem to work together with this. And one is he says Damchi Lozen Vuhu Dag Shidoyme Eino Le Einat Cheles. He says a dug. He says a dug. Dug translates as fish. So I actually heard one shir which started with this Rambam. None of the background, none of the connections, none of the back. It started off with the Rambam. Okay, you can see the agenda of the shir if that's where you start your shir. Nonetheless, okay. So let's just a few things to bear in mind when it comes to this. First of all, the question is how limited is the word dug? First of all, right? Does the word dug mean specifically something with snappier of a cascasis? It means something that's got fins and scales? Is it a broader category of aquatic life in general? There's a Vilna Gaon and Kalim that talks about kol. He actually raises the girsa chaya shebayam because he says the word dag includes kol chaya shebayam as an example. But more than that, you have to be intellectually honest. If you look at the Rambam in the Pirush Mishnayos in Kalim Perek Yud Beis, the Rambam talks about the chilazon and he talks about it. The word that he uses for it is he talks about it with a mitzvah. Mitzvah is the Arabic word for a shell. The Rambam himself, the same Rambam, the Rambam who wrote. The Rambam wrote the Yad, wrote in his Pirush Mishnayos, he talks about the chilazon which has a mitzvah. So wait a second. How can it be both? How can the Rambam be dancing on both sides of the fence? Unless Dag is a more expansive version. I understand this. Also, it's a good question. The question is like this. Here we go. Does the Gemara ever say it's a Dag? No. The Gemara says it is Briyasai Kadag. It's the way it's formed, whatever that is. A very vague description is a Dag. The Gemara never says that. The Rishonim, some of the Rishonim, Tosfos and the Rambam say it's a Dag. Right? And the question is, how broad a category are they referring to? But let's understand something. Who was looking at the Chilazon? Who was looking at the Tcheles? Who lived at the time of the Tcheles? The Gemara. The Rambam and the Tosfos lived at the time 600 years post the usage of the Tcheles. Now, the Radzina Rebbe actually argued that he believed that the Rambam had it. It doesn't seem that that is the truth. It doesn't seem that the Rambam had it. 600 years afterwards, so the Rambam is doing the very best he can. As another example, let's imagine we lost what it was to have the Lulav and Esrog. We lost the Arba Minim, right? So we didn't have them. We went to the right countries. We went to the right place. The climate was incorrect. And now we go back to the Gemara and the Rishon to work out what they are. So we say that we see that the Lulav has got a lave. It's got a lave, right? Then we see that there's a choitem on the Arabas. So wait a second. So we go through all these signs. And you're like, so what is it? Does this plant have a lave? What's the lave over here? The answer is, if you know what it is, then everything makes sense. All the metaphoric descriptions make sense. If you don't know what it is, you're never going to arrive at the right answer just by looking at this as the specifics. So when it talks about a dug, yes, it is something which swims in the sea. But if you know what it is, then of course, retroactively, of course, everything makes sense. When the Gemara says chilazon and it refers to a snail, because that's the word for snail in those days, then of course it makes sense retroactively that it refers to that. But looking a priori, it's very hard to be able to get to that. Another question which is raised. Let's see if we can get over here. The creation of Daimeh, it says it's Briyasai Daimeh Ledag. It's Briya is similar to a fish. That's a very vague statement. So they say it isn't created like a fish. Well, it lays eggs like a fish. It grows in the sea. It spawns like a fish. Right? It grows in the ocean like a fish. So how specific or how vague is this description? How much of a pircha is this to the question when we have a vague description? As another example. Now, an example. This is the famous Gemara. The Gemara says that a person who's tzad chilazon and poitzoi is enochayev al achas. He does two melachas on Shabbos. He hunts it and he breaks it open. Right? So first of all, the fact that it says poitzoi clearly indicates that you're breaking open something. Most people forget the second half of that Gemara. They only quote the first three words, tzad chilazon. In sort of half the sentence, we'll bifurcate it, we'll quote that as a proof against. And the question that's raised is, it's nitzad me'elov. The question is like this. Is a halacha. If you have a creature which doesn't have any way of getting away, and you hunt it, you're not chayav on Shabbos for it because it's nitzod me'elov. It's hunted by itself. You don't have to do anything special. So the question is you walk into the ocean, you walk down, you look in the rock pools, you pick it right up off the ocean floor, and there you have it. It's nitzod me'elov. How can it be considered? How can it be considered tzriya on Shabbos? How can it be considered tzad if it requires very little effort? And the truth is that there's many answers to this question. It's not so simple. Yes, I can get one or two in the rock pools. The amount that they use for making tzitzis are not created rock pools. They go in with nets. They go in with scuba diving gear. It requires a lot. It's not a b'shechiyah achas. It's not as if you know just walk in one day and pick up one murex. You require 25 of them just for one set of tzitzis. You need to go in on a more industrial level. That requires a lot of work. That requires tzitzia. It's very hard to say this would be a pircha. The exposure to sunlight. I heard somebody once say, you know, the Rambam leaves out the main category, the main principal point of dyeing the tchelis. He never mentions going outside. He never mentions going outside. If the whole point of turning it from purple to blue is that it really needs to be exposed to sunlight, the Rambam never says that. Ikar chosam min ha-sefer. The main point is left out of the Rambam. And in those days, all factories were inside, says the author of the shir. That's a very big claim to make. Do you know where they were? Do you know where were they catching chilas on? On the seacoast. Go there today. You can go up north, and you look and you see where they're catching them. In the little rock pools on the sand, on the shore, in the little rock pools on the side of the Mediterranean. Does it not stand to reason that they could have been doing some of the dyeing process outside under little gondolas? And do you think that factories were only inside in those days? To say that the Rambam's leaving out a main point by not saying taking it outside, because an obvious point, obvious part of the production was exposing it to sunlight, I don't know. I would argue the other way. Who would say that the production was done inside? How do we know? Is that really an intellectually honest question to ask? Now another question. This is actually what it looks like when you're doing. This is actually in the Einat Cheles itself. The guy's wearing the shirt with a chemical formula on it, as you can see. Then another question, which is I've heard is a proof by omission. He has a question which is asked. Questions like this. Wait a second. The Gemara spends so much time describing the Cheles, the Chilazon, right, used for the Cheles, but it never talks about the Argamon, the production of Argamon. The Gemara never talks about Argamon. Why? So what do you see from here? This is how the question goes. You see that everybody knew that argamon was produced by murex. So the Gemara never needed to talk about that because it was all produced by something which was obvious. The chilazon was this obscure creature which the Gemara now knows that he needs to go into all these details to describe. It's doim elyon, briyos ha'ladag, it's oil achas l'shiv b'shon, all these things. Why? Because it was much harder to find than the argamon. Why would the Gemara dedicate so much time to the tcheles and not any time to the argamon? Clearly, it must be a different and much more obscure creature. That's such a... I have to apologize. When I heard somebody say this, I was so shocked at the intellectual dishonesty of such a question. I was so shocked. The reason why the Gemara may not discuss it is because the argument is used for the Big Day Kohona is used in the Beis Hamikdash in the Mishkan. The Tchelis is used by every single male in Klal Yisrael. Of course, the Gemara is going to dedicate time to it.
How do you know that everyone had the Tchelis at the time of the Gemara? Maybe it was so expensive that only the rich people were able to use it.
Reb Shmuel, when the Torah says, gives the mitzvah and it says you should put a psil tcheles on your beged, that's not a mitzvah. That's not a mitzvah to the elite. That's a mitzvah to the hamonam. The Torah demands things which we can do.
It's like lulav and esrog.
It's very hard to say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would make a mitzvah which was inaccessible to the hamonam, and then have an issue. Very hard to know. And in fact, as we learned last time when we learned together, there's a machloek is Rebbe Nachachamim, where it's ma'akev or not. According to Rebbe, it's ma'akev, not having a tchelis. So you're going to say that through the entire time the Gemara, Rebbe is living at the time of tchelis is extant, and he says it's ma'akev. He says that you cannot fulfill the mitzvah tzitzis without tchelis at the time when most people don't have it. Very hard to say. Very hard to say.
Rabbi, not everybody had an
esrog. What was that? There were times in Europe, correct, there were times in Europe because they don't grow esrogim in Europe. Israel is where they grow them. Let's go a little further. Okay? Now I want to just close this section. Now, many more questions, there are many more proofs. But let's go a little further. In terms of the questions over here. So one of the questions is, so what do you have to lose? You know, so let's go from that perspective. Rav Herschel Schacht has a beautiful mamar on this, and he says, like, look, what is at stake over here? Here we have what's called a Sofik Do'araisa. So here we are. I have ostensible proof. It sounds like a lot of it adds up. There are questions to it. So it's not 100%. A lot of things add up to it. And now, if I were to do it, I have Sofek. I've in doubt, perhaps, a full D'oraisa. What's the rule when it comes to a Sofek D'oraisa? You go to Chumrah. In any regular situation, if you don't know if you're going to fulfill a mitzvah midaraisa, you go for it, if there's no other cost. There's a question on this. So Rav Shechter raises a question on this. Some people say that this is limited to a case where you know, bevadai, that you have fulfilled the mitzvah after you've done the safek. Meaning, let's say I didn't do Birkas HaMazon as an example. I don't know if I benched. Birkas HaMazon, unlike most of the other brachas, is midaraisa as opposed to midrabanan. So what should I do? If I'm still full and I don't know if I benched, first of all, you should try to remember better next time. But number two is you should bench again because Sofik Dorais, look over it. But once I've benched, I've definitely fulfilled the Chiyuv, whichever way. Over here, I may not have, right? Because even though I did a Sofik Dorais, I may not have, by performing this, I may not have done it yet because it may not be the right thing. That is correct. Radzina Rebbe already addressed this. He says, but what do you have to lose? Go for a try. He has an opportunity of Mitzvah Midoraisa. There are questions in this. As an example. There's an example which is asked the following. The Gemara which says about the Kala Ilan, the indigo, right? The Gemara says that Kosh Baruch Hu says, I know the difference between Kala Ilan, plant-based indigo, and the mirror, and the real Tcheles. So there's Ben Yehoyada who says the Gematria over there relates to the Samoel, relates to the Malach HaMavis, the Satan, that wearing the plant indigo is a bad thing. Meaning, and therefore, if there are certain poskim, very well-renowned poskim who say, there is a concern that if you're wearing the wrong thing, you get yourself into Kabbalistically some sort of complication by wearing the wrong thing. Now, it's hard to understand this for a number of reasons. Number one is, since when does a Sofik Da'araisa compared to a potential mystical concern that recorded in the Ben Yehoyada, the Ben Yishchai, and the Gemara, that's put on the same level? Is that the way we paskin halacha? Even if a machlok is nigla nista, the Chasam Sofer says we go after the nigla. There's no question. Sofik Da'araisa versus a chashash mikabola. As an example, that's not the way we pass in halacha. Another example, another point is what is the case, this is what Radzina Rebbe says himself, what's the case of the Kala Ilan, the indigo? It's not referring to a person who's trying to fulfill a mitzvah. What's it referring to? It's referring to the black market. It's referring to bad people who are using plant-based indigo to sell it on market for the high value of the real tcheles when indigo is cheap, because I can get it from the plants and it's everywhere, and those people are nefariously trying to get money and allow people not to fulfill the mitzvah. That's what we're referring to. It's not referring to a person who's tried and spent their whole life researching the tcheles and believes this is the right way to do it and is now doing it and is now fulfilling it. That's not what the Gemara is referring to. It's not referring to an altruistic-based individual. And it's specifically maybe referring only to the plant-based indigo, not any other imposters that exist there. Very hard to understand. And I'd like to close with the quote of Rav Chaim Twersky, just because this is his perspective, and he says the following: if I may offer my own humble opinion, it would seem, in other words, the word humble is important over here, because we're trying to find the truth, we're not trying to prove our own opinions. If I may offer my own humble opinion, it would seem that this identification ought to be accepted by many, if not the majority of poskim, but it will likely take much time for this to happen. For halacha is by its very nature conservative, and in general, a consensus is reached only after much debate and deliberation. For the meantime, until a consensus is reached, each Rav should do according to the dictates of his own reasoning. If after careful study of all material he is skeptical, there is no reason for him to wear the tcheles made from Murex trunculus or instruct others to do so. If, on the other hand, one is reasonably convinced, that the Murex trunculus is indeed the chilazon, he should wear them and rule for those who ask and rely upon his rulings. Does he say that it's absolute? No. Does he say we dismiss it absolute? No. When Rav Shechter, who wears tcheles, was once asked, somebody came up to him in the street and said, Rav Shechter, why is that you wear tcheles? His answer, he says, oh, somebody gave it to me as a gift. Because in the street is not the way to answer Shaila. If you want to ask Rav Shechter properly, go and read his whole mimer of 30 pages on the tcheles, where he says it's an Isra of Bal Tigra, not wearing it when we know that it's around today. That's a very serious assertion, based on the Beis Halevi, not himself. So when it comes to these things, there are many poskim who are not misyaches to it. They don't actually address it. And if anybody and if a particular poskim says or person says, my Rebbe, my Dayan, my Remori D'Asher doesn't wear, and that I don't wear, that's perfectly acceptable. They're not at a place. This is not where they are. People should not have things forced down their throats. They do not feel this is correct or the right time. That there's no Masora, that's fine. On the other hand, there are many Gedolei HaPoskim who do wear and do instruct. There are many Gedolei HaPoskim who wear privately but don't instruct. And I think, therefore, it requires a great amount of humility and appreciation of this parasha to know and understand that, yes, Baruch Hashem, we're living at a time where we have the opportunity, the anticipation of the revealing, or potentially the revelation of what could potentially and very, very likely, what many, many, many indicators point to in the Gemara and in the history, which matches the Gemara. Not just the history, not just the Gemara, which seem to match up to point to the Mirax Tranquilus being, in fact, the Tcheles. But at this point in time, it is absolutely important to realize that there are different Zeramim Mipsak, and to dismiss one or to dismiss the other is, in a certain sense, fallacious. To dismiss altogether this is a Taina is incorrect. To dismiss that the people who say that it's not the right time is also incorrect. Be'ezras Hashem, we should have the opportunity of seeing Emes La'amitzoi Be'ezras Hashem, Be'korov, Be'omeinu, Be'viyasa Mashiach, Be'meru Yomeinu.